Is only one person signed up to testify on this bill? I've got this sneaking suspicion. I'm sorry? Okay. If you're planning on testifying on this bill, if you could sign up so that I can see who's in favor, who's opposed, and how many, and plan the time accordingly, that would be great.
Derek,
you're going to open that other one also. Committee will stand at ease for 1 second.
So it's still open.
Yes.
An open question.
We've got it. Yes. We will have issues to deal with.
Do we know what we're doing? Do I know what you're doing?
1008.
What happened to?
Why should they be different than the other day?
Cletus, if you'll read the read the bill summary, we heard it the other day.
Mr. Chair and Committee, Senate Bill 1008, A. Engrossed, establishes Oregon Community Power, OCP, establishes mechanism of organization and management of OCP, and for OCP to enter into negotiations and acquire assets of Portland General Electric Company, known as PGE, establishes which public agency laws apply and do not apply to OCP, authorizes state electric state treasurer at request of OCP to issue revenue bonds, and directs OCP to expend bond proceeds to acquire assets of PGE, creates financing mechanism of OCP for purpose of acquisition of PGE, debt service and operation of electric utility, limits expenditures of bond proceeds and debt service monies, declares emergency effective on passage. This measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Budget, and also in your packet is a summary of SB 1008 as it was in the Senate, along with the amendments to the bill, as well as a summary of revenue and fiscal.
Thank you, Cletus. Clear as mud. You want to get the... see, Senator Deckert and Senator Nelson are here with us, and Representative Berger. If y'all want to just wait till everybody else is done testifying just to see your patience, I'm fine with that. Or you can go first.
Hello, George. You have a great sense of humor.
Yeah, right.
We're all laughing.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yes, I don't understand.
The contempt I feel. That's okay. You and Representative Holby will have something in common next week. I will be opposing both your bills, so that is fine. And you can.
I can't wait till that circus starts.
Fine young cannibals. Gentlemen, thank you. Lady. Ma'am, the Honorable.
You ready?
You make it
first. Well, you have, and I just...
Well, we're in the House now, though.
We have...
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. We are really pleased to be before you with Senate Bill 1008. I am Ryan Deckard, State Senator from Beaverton and Southwest Portland, Alloa, and a tad of, actually, Hillsboro. So, Mr. Chair, we're neighbors in that respect. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and describe the development of Senate Bill 1008, which we worked a great deal in the State Senate, which creates a public corporation called Oregon Community Power to purchase and operate PGE. Now, since the initial hearings on this, obviously much has occurred, and the City of Portland is well into discussions, signed a confidentiality agreement, and really that purchase part is the City of Portland has that field and is operating on that field and is well down the line in terms of this discussion since our first hearing that we had on this bill. Senator Nelson, Representative Berger, and I introduced Senate Bill 1008 because we were frustrated by the lack of appealing options to take over operations of PGE, which does serve over half 50% of all customers and residents in the state of Oregon. We conceived Senate Bill 1008 as a vehicle to allow PG's customers, and I think that is what you will hear over and over again from us, Mr. Chair, is that we worked with and see this as an option for the customers of PGE, and that is the families that reside in the PGE service territory and the businesses, small and large, that reside in their territory, shaped by them, by investors in other states, and we did not want to see their destiny shaped. Investors, understandably, are interested in solid returns. Customers, on the other hand, are interested in the reliable electricity and competitive rates. As introduced, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1008 was a legislative shell that outlined our basic concept. What we've done since then is really put meat on the bones of that concept. We had a work group authorized by the chair of the Senate Business Committee, which included representatives just about everyone that's playing in this field, the co-ops, the cities, the counties, and mainly the customer groups, ICNU, CUB, and AOI, representing the interests of the customers, and that is the product that you see in front of you encompassed in Senate Bill 1008. There were three central issues that we needed to address. One, and chiefly, is benefit to ratepayers. And the communities touched by PGE. We are all aware of the sea of uncertainty that this utility has found itself in, beginning with Enron and the 53% rate increase that hit our families and our business in the state and really affected our competitive advantages that we had had. I don't need to tell this committee that it was workers' comp and energy that were the two competitive advantages that Oregon had, and no longer is energy one of those, and so we are left with simply workers' comp rate as our real competitive advantages for our business in the state, and that is really, I think, what drove us to introduce this bill. We wanted to ensure that there was accountability and an appropriate and representative governance structure. Senator Nelson will discuss our deliberation on governance, and Representative Berger will talk about accountability and a few other things. I will begin by briefly describing the benefits we see in our proposal. Following us will be a panel of witnesses representing customers who will offer their views on the overall promise of Senate Bill 1008 and these three central issues. Mr. Chair, the three benefits that we see is, one, it's a proven model. Oregon has been successful in creating effective single-purpose public corporations such as OHSU, the Port of Portland, and in the case of Oregon Community Power, we are creating that same public corporation model. We think it's been effective. Some of the members of the committee have been very familiar with this model of OHSU, and it really marries the benefits of a public mission, which would be reliability and rate reduction, but also keeping it at arm length from government and allowing it to run like a private corporation. And we
I didn't see the advantage of expanding that.
That's true. That is true. The financial advantages, and Mr. Chair, I think this is the area that really got the interest of certainly the three of us, is when we looked at the financial advantages that this utility would have as Oregon Community Power, they are strong. And we looked at the LIPA deal, the last acquisition, Long Island Power Authority, which Governor Pataki and Mayor Giuliani really engineered 5 years ago. Same set of scenario and about the same size of utility. They have delivered a 20% over 5 years rate cut to their customers, and it's because of three things. One is the tax advantages that they enjoy. Secondly, by not paying federal and state taxes and plowing those back into rate reduction. Secondly, whenever you do go out and do a capital project, and I've chosen the project that's on the coast. I believe it's Port Westward. We, just by paying lower interest rates on that one project, our financial analysis of it by UBS is that you would save $140 million just in the interest rate savings that you had on that one capital project. Now, in reading the statute, we take that $140 million and any savings that are accrued, and that's just one capital project, and we plow them back to the benefit of ratepayers, into lower rates for ratepayers. And that's just one project that we decided that would be worthy of taking a look at and seeing how much of an advantage you could provide to ratepayers. The third is obviously that the 10 or so percent that now goes to shareholders would obviously be managed on behalf of customers and plowed back into rate reduction. And so the 48 million Americans that receive some form of public power, we believe, and two-thirds of Washington and a great deal of California and citizens on the West Coast do, we certainly feel that there are rate advantages and reliability advantages that brought us to this table. The third, Mr. Chair, advantage that we see is local control. We have all been through, and the employees at PG, frankly, have been through this, the up and down and in and out of who controls this utility. And that's the chief concern I have with the stock distribution plan is that it just continues this pattern of no local control over such an important asset to the future of the state and the economic viability of the state. And that is why I think we're also here before you with Senate Bill 1008, because we really feel like on those three marks, it is the best plan. It's regional in nature. It encompasses all citizens that are in the PGE territory. And it should be able to deliver a huge advantage to the ratepayers and the citizens of the region on both on rate reduction and local control and reliability. With that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the indulgence of my presentation, and I will hand it off to Senator David Nelson.
Thank you, Senator, and Senator Nelson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator representing District 29, which is four counties in northeast Oregon, Marl County, Umatilla County, Union County, and Wallowa County. And that's one of the reasons I'm here. PGE actually owns two power plants in Marl County. They're the largest taxpayer or property taxpayer for Morrill County. So they have some real concerns about the governance issue, and so they called me up with their concerns and asked me to get involved in this process. And their concerns, and I guess my concern would be then, is that when I looked at having Portland as the only entity out there that would be controlling this, they were asking me how would they get any representation if Portland owned this company, you know, and I want to make sure it's clear to the board. I think Portland's, you know, they have an absolute right to do what they're doing, you know, if they're the successful one, that's fine. But the concern for my constituents' part was, where do they get a voice in this process? And so when it came to me, they said they would be much rather involved with a statewide thing, where at least they'd have a member of the House of Representatives or a member of the Senate that would be could have some influence or some impact on decision making. So they were much more supportive of a statewide concept that the state of Oregon would be involved in it. So that was one constituency that I was involved with. The other constituency was the consumer-owned utilities. I have two consumer-owned utilities, actually three, and then one municipal. And this has to do with the preference power issue, Bonneville Dam, you know, public power companies under federal law have a right to preference power. Their concern is right now the Bonneville system is oversubscribed, and they felt if they had a utility this large coming in to the process now that would potentially could affect their rates. And so they wanted to make sure that I was taken care of. So in this bill, 1008, we have a provision that on the first issue that the Oregon Community Power will hold local communities harmless for property taxes and franchise fees that PGE now pays. So that's taken care of. And also bill indicates that the Oregon Power Corporation cannot exercise a right to claim preference power from the Bonneville Power Administration. So I think those two issues have been answered from my viewpoint. You know, and hopefully you consider this, that you'll look at those two things, because it is a statewide issue from that viewpoint. I do know that there is another proposal, probably will be presented to you today, where somehow you would marry the concept of Portland with the statewide opposition or statewide thing. And I'm just saying, I don't know what it is. I just heard about that's out there, but I'd have to look at it to see where we're at with that thing. I don't know what that says.
Senator, it's not the intention of this committee to marry or amend any bill today.
Okay.
But it may be the direction this committee goes. So I would suggest that you do look at that, but it'll be sometime next week if that's the case.
That would be good. Okay. And so I understand and appreciate the fact that the committee is willing to look at many things, because you know, this is a very interesting, very important concept, and appreciate your attention, and I'll turn it over to Representative Berger.
Thank you. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Members of the committee, thank you for your attention. Senator Nelson, Senator Deckard, and I have been working very hard on this whole concept over in the Senate. As you can see, it's a big, complicated piece of legislation, and it reflects a huge amount of work by a lot of people to bring it to you in a form that is appropriate for the importance of it. And that's really what I like most about it. It is created out of a legislative process where everyone is brought to the table to bring their issues forward, such as the ones Senator Nelson just talked about, and get them out there so that in the public sense, we are creating a public entity created in a public way during a public venue, the legislature. It is one of its greatest strengths. I have some other things in my notes here to talk about here, and I will go through them fairly quickly and then conclude so you can hear from the folks who have done some of the really heavy lifting about the what this bill does. In rate setting, this power won't be subject to the Public Utilities Commission rate review, and customers themselves have devised a rate setting procedure based on standards of cost-based rates for each class of customer. The rates will include cost to maintain and operate electric utility distribution and transmission lines, pay property taxes, and franchise fees, and debt service. In other words, all of those local government pieces will be held harmless under this so that the local governments won't lose the taxation that they're deriving now. Rate setting will occur under rules relating to open meetings and public records. Senate Bill 108 provides for an annual independent audit of Oregon Community Power. The legislation requires Oregon Community Power to maintain books and records in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles and a uniform set of accounts established by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And great care has been taken to transfer the responsibilities and obligations of PGE, which they now have, over to Oregon Community Power regarding the public purpose provisions of Oregon's competitive electric market legislation, which was Senate Bill 1149, the sort of 1149 provisions. This has been a delicate and time-consuming process, but it's in here, and it's for everyone to see and recognize. I think I had. Let me wrap up here. What we need in this state is power that is affordable, accessible, locally controlled. We need to take control of our own destiny, and we have a golden opportunity right now. There have been four different attempts to buy PGE by private entities. They've all failed. We've now at a point where we can't go on having this important piece in limbo. And the critical piece for me is that a public power structure has to represent everyone in the state of Oregon. I passed out for you a map of the PGE service area. I think Senator Nelson just discussed that along with the six counties that PGE operates in, there's areas all over the state where 10 different areas where they are creating power through some sort of a facility. PGE is a statewide asset. It is a statewide issue. And what this gives us is a governance structure for a statewide public utility. And it's a really good model for how to do this in an open process, bring everybody to the table, and design for ourselves a model that's going to help Oregon. It's a huge economic development piece for me because power issues, the cost of power, is going to make a big difference in our ability to attract the kind of businesses we're going to need to keep our economy going. So I thank you for your attention. I thank you for the time you're going to spend on this bill, and would be available for questions at any time during your deliberations and testimony.
I think there might be a few. Thank you, Representative Greenleaf.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I need to read shortly. I'll get caught up on this after I get land use straightened out. I have become a little familiar with the public corporation model because of my proposal to expand the OHSU and to include PSU. And my understanding is that a public corporation is as we formed it, is basically the same as a state government. In fact, it's part of the executive department of the state. The difference being, not every statute that applies to a state executive department applies to this. I wonder if you could just sort of outline which are the statutes that either do apply or don't apply. I don't mean statute by statute, but generally the outline of what's included in this public corporation as opposed to what's not included in this public corporation.
I'm looking for that.
Well, they're looking for it. If I could just answer some of that general basis, Mr. Chair, and where's a good look. You know, the OHSU model basically was designed to give that health care the ability to go out and be more flexible. I think that's the overriding thing that we're looking for. Like, for instance, in this bill, employees of the Oregon Community Power would not be eligible for PERS. I mean, that's one thing we specifically put in there. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things of that nature. But, I mean, what we're trying to do is figure out an organization that can be flexible, that the state isn't going to run this. This is going to be run by a board of directors and people that are expert in the business. This is not that the state's going to jump in.
It actually is going to be the state. I mean, that's the important point.
Well,
that board is appointed by the governor. It's serving, in fact, as an executive arm of the state. But the question is, for example, are open meeting laws apply to this? I mean, I was just asking what makes it, what's in, what's out, roughly. And maybe the thing to do, maybe you could answer it, you know, in a memo later or something. Is this...
I think that may be the thing to do.
or, Mr. Chair, I would say, think OHSU. You see in the bill...
OHSU PERS does apply.
But we specifically wanted to say on matters like that, and so we did it in law, in writing, we said, these would not be PERS employees. But we went through and tried to, I don't know if divorce is the right word, but put this at arm's length from the state, for a lot of reasons. One is this entity could actually acquire, we believe, acquire stock, which is a big issue for the trustees of Enron. The city of Portland has devised another way of going about that, that issue of acquiring stock. But this entity would be, as a public corporation, just like OHSU does acquire stock. This entity could do that, or at least our financial person thinks so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckert, if it's in response to the statute-by-statute reference of representative agreement, I would probably ask that you put that in the form of a memo, as I can see it provoking thousands of other questions. The stock option issue that you just spoke of, Senator, that's not been confirmed whether or not... There's some unclarity as to whether or not that will actually be the case. Is that correct? Or has there been some ruling, or is there a definitive nature that, yes, you can, in fact, issue stock?
Issue stock or hold stock?
Purchase stock.
Purchase stock, yeah.
That's right. Mr. Chair, in some ways, this was a very important issue when it was in the Senate. Now that the city of Portland is so far along in terms of the acquisition, that it is, frankly, a less important question. But it was our bond counsel's opinion at the time. How you draft it matters. If you keep it at arm's length, so it's not a state agency, because state agencies in the Constitution can't acquire stock, if it is at arm's length, and so you see it was drafted to ensure that this entity, Oregon Community Power, would be very much unlike a state agency in so many different ways, that yes, then it is his opinion, although he was the person who helped create the OHSU statute, okay, and wrote the OHSU statute, that it could acquire stock.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, in answer, I was furiously when Representative Greenlit came up with this question on governance. I know he's a careful reader of the bills before him, and during the Senate hearing, counsel outlined I will see that you get a copy, a sort of a cheat sheet of what's in it, and the governance pieces are in section 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, and I would encourage him to read it and be careful and diligent in looking over what the provisions are, and that, as I say, is the advantage of this. You can read it. You can read it for yourself.
Mr. Just in a comment. I mean, I first got
go ahead and make a comment.
An inclination about this when I asked if I could be named to the OHSU board and was told I couldn't as a legislature because OHSU is formally a part of, it is an executive department of the state as it's been formed. It just doesn't have to conform to all the various statutes only to the statutes that are written into its, essentially into its legislation. So my assumption is if the board's appointed by the governor, serves by the governor, is a public corporation as OHSU, it then is a part of the executive arm of the state, but with very narrow constraints. So I think it is important what's included in those constraints and what's not. For example, when OHSU went to a public corporation, the statutes wrote in that the contracts that were enforced at the time, labor contracts, would remain in force. The people would be in PERS. That was written in as opposed to being written out. But so it will only be what you have written in.
Right. Thank you for that. If you all could, I've got a list of questions, but I don't want to. I'd rather get through some of the testimony in case they're answered in that, so that it doesn't become redundant for the committee. But if y'all could stick around for a little bit, unless you have somewhere else
Mr.
to go.
Chair, I am in the Revenue Committee next door, if needed.
I'm sure Senator
I can
Decker
be pulled out, but I will be chairing it towards the end of the session.
I'll be in the Senate hearing room after.
And we'll be checking to make sure that you're not lying to the committee just to get out of here.
And Mr. Chair, we too depend on the experts behind us who are power experts.
But I just want you to have to sit here and suffer.
I understand.
You mean this one?
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Senator Decker.
Yeah, not by staff.
Seeing too much of you of late.
Good. He always gets his way in this committee, though, Mr. Chair.
I was commenting on Senator Deckert's behavior in our business committee earlier. I said, very genteel, very statesmanlike. I said, I've got to learn that trait, but I appreciate your testimony. At this point, we'll call up Gary, Brad, Julie, and Jeff.
Derek, if you need me, I'm in 50.
50? Annetta, can we verify that?
Turn the television on.
go get land use. Figure it out. What? Yeah, fine. Yeah.
Derek, I'll be
sitting right to my right. Holly, that'll be the only time you get to my right. I promise you that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, here today representing Washington County. And let me first say that Chair Tom Bryan was unable to be here today, had a conflict. So while no one can really quite fill in for him, I am more or less his replacement today. And the role I'll serve on this panel is to try to give you, in broad sense, an outline of what's in the bill. My colleagues who represent different customer groups, I think, will fill in the blanks and tell you also why they have worked on this bill and what value they see in the bill. Let me first start off by noting that the question that Representative Greenlick asked about a public corporation, that he was asking what was in, what was out. It's an important question to note that one of the reasons why we chose this form as the basis for a customer-owned utility is because under Oregon law, public corporations have that character. You can essentially customize the design of the corporation to fit the task. The Port of Portland, Oregon Health and Science University, and SAFE, for example, are quite different from each other because they have different responsibilities and different needs. Thus, Oregon Community Power also could be uniquely designed in state law to meet the requirements of operating a sophisticated utility such as PGE. It also has the benefit of being a unique utility that's a customer-owned utility without impacting in any unintentional or inadvertent ways the statutes regarding municipal utilities, people's utility districts, or rural electric co-ops. I think the sponsors of the bill gave you a pretty good overview of what the purpose of the bill is. I might just spend a few moments on the governance questions because there have been a number of questions about that. What is provided for is a 7-member board that would be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. However, unlike sort of a normal vetting process for an appointment, this bill provides for a nominating committee. And that nominating committee, for the at least the initial board, consists of representatives who are the people who either have a statutory standing or are the most frequent representatives of residential, commercial, and industrial ratepayers, who are the people who pay the bills, if you will, at PGE, and incidentally their rates also are the fees, become the fees that help pay for the rate setting process at the Public Utility Commission. These are the people who will have an influence on who will be the board members. In addition to those three will be a representative of cities and counties, who also, I think, represent important constituencies for this utility, not only in the service territory that PGE serves, but in addition to that, as Senator Nelson noted, this utility owns facilities, it has transmission lines and other interests throughout the state. And so it's important that cities and counties, people who reflect the interests of elected community people, also have a voice in who the nominees would be that ultimately the governor would choose from to select the board. The question about the qualifications of members of the board are also noted. They're included, by the way, on page 4 of the bill, and they include having significant experience or expertise in one or more of the following areas, and they are business operations, utility management, legal or financial affairs, regional energy issues, or developing public policy. So it's intended to produce a board that will be professional and businesslike and experienced in the conduct of business for a utility of this size and scope. I'm going to let the customers talk about the rate setting procedure, because I think that they're uniquely capable of doing it because they're the ones that deal with the rate setting procedures today. But I might just comment that from my vantage point of observing it, what I think they've created is something that's very elegant, effective, and much more inexpensive than the current system that we have today in terms of representing ratepayer interests. An important topic, I think, to note is, since we talked about this just a moment ago, is the various powers or acts, state acts, that would apply and which ones would not. And I'm going to give you a sampler. I can provide you, in fact, this copy, Mr. Chair, at your request. This list was prepared by Legislative Council, and so I will supply it to you. I did not bring extra copies today, but let me give you a cross-section of state laws that do apply to Senate Bill 1008. Eminent domain procedures, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Public records law.
Gary, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is this the document you're referring
yes.
to? We do have a copy.
Okay.
So.
Well, I'll just highlight a couple. Public meetings law, government standards and practices, code of ethics, conflict of interest procedures, tort actions, collective bargaining. Things that do not apply, I'll highlight some of those. PERS, Department of Administrative Services Oversight, public contracting, prevailing wage, public employee salaries, Attorney General management of eminent domain, state archives role, employee benefit plan requirements, and there are a few others. If you've seen them there, I might also note mandatory safe workers' compensation coverage. But as you can see, a thoughtful effort has been put in place to make sure that Oregon Community Power would be able to function and operate in a business-like fashion. Let me just touch a moment on eminent domain. Eminent domain is something that
Decker.
Oregon Community Power acquires only at the point of actually purchasing the utility. In other words, it does not have the ability to use eminent domain to acquire PGE. The intent is to use eminent domain only in the normal conduct of business, and it cannot use eminent domain to acquire exclusive territory of any other utility. There are a number of accountability provisions that Representative Berger noted, including independent audits. Let me just touch on, finally, and then I'll let others talk more about this, is the issue of bonding. And this is a policy question that is out there that could be answered as to who would actually issue the bonds relative to an acquisition of the utility, of whether or not there would be a state treasurer or the utility itself. The way the bill is currently written is that it would authorize the state treasurer to issue those bonds, but it's also possible, and there may be advantages, to have the utility itself be the bond issuer. This is relevant, particularly in any kind of a context where the potential of the city of Portland being the bidder, but ultimately Oregon Community Power being the buyer, takes effect. There is a discussion going on about the potential merger of a bidding and acquisition strategy involving the city of Portland, and so it's relevant to have some thought about the bond issuance, because it would in fact be either the utility or the state that would be issuing non-recourse revenue bonds. These are not bonds backed by any general obligation of taxpayers, but really based on the assets and the cash flow from ratepayers of the utility itself. And with that, Madam Vice Chair, I'll turn it over to Brad.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Brad Van Cleve, and I'm appearing on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. We're here today to support Senate Bill 1008, and not necessarily because we think it's the only answer to the PGE ownership question, but we think that it might be the right answer, and therefore it deserves to be an option that's on the table. In looking at the various options for PGE ownership, there's a couple of guiding principles that we've looked at. First, we think there needs to be a model for stable long-term ownership of PGE. Second, and maybe most importantly, we think there needs to be an opportunity to lower costs and hopefully reduce PGE's high rates. Third, we think that any solution needs to incorporate the policies of Senate Bill 1149, which was passed by the 1999 legislature and provides for direct access and funding of public purposes. Fourth, we think there needs to be a fair and non-discriminatory process for setting rates. And fifth, there needs to be an independent but accountable governance structure that represents the interests of customers. We believe that Senate Bill 1008 satisfies each of these goals, and on the important goal of lowering costs, while there's no guarantee that PGE's rates will go down, Oregon Community Power creates the following cost advantages, which I think you've already heard about: ability to finance with tax-exempt debt, an exemption from income taxes, and no required rate of return for utility shareholders. We were asked early on to assist in the drafting and development of Senate Bill 1008, and unlike some of the other options on the table, the customers had a very strong role in developing the concept. And my role in working on the bill was to focus on three areas: incorporating the relevant provisions of Senate Bill 1149 without making substantive changes to existing law, ensuring that the transition process to the new utility would be as easy as possible from a customer perspective, and ensuring that a fair and non-discriminatory rate process was put in place to replace PUC regulation. And I'll just quickly go through how the bill addresses each of those issues. First, on Senate Bill 1149, Oregon Community Power is required by the statute to offer direct access to all non-residential customers. This is the same obligation that PGE currently has, and that would be transferred to the new public corporation. On the issue of portfolio access, which is the pricing options for residential customers. The bill leaves the decision on what to offer in that regard up to the board. With respect to public purposes, Oregon Community Power would collect the 3% public purpose charge that's currently in PGE's rates and would continue to provide those monies to the Oregon Energy Trust or such other entity as the Oregon PUC designates. And that kind of leads me to what the role of the PUC will be if Oregon Community Power is put into existence and acquires PGE or its assets. The PUC will not regulate the rates of Oregon Community Power, but it will continue to have a significant role in the implementation of the Senate Bill 1149 options. It will continue to regulate energy service suppliers, and these are the power suppliers that directly serve some of PGE's customers currently. It will be responsible for resolving disputes between these energy suppliers and Oregon Community Power, and it will continue to enforce the consumer protection rules that have been developed under Senate Bill 1149. And finally, as I mentioned, the PUC will continue to administer the collection and use of the 3% public purpose charge. The next issue has to do with the transition period, and our purpose here was to create as seamless a process from the customer point of view as possible. So what the bill requires is that Oregon Community Power adopt the existing rate schedules of PGE, and these will remain in place until the board adopts a set of rules governing rate hearings and conducts a rate case to set new rates. So on day one, customers will see little change. And this includes adopting all of the existing tariffs, rules, and billing systems of PGE. And finally, the books and records of Oregon Community Power will be kept in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles and FERC rules. So during this transition phase, there will not be any change in the accounting practices.
Brad, can you for a quick reference, tell me where the accounting practices are and what section?
Yes, Chair Kitts. I believe it's in Section 23 of the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead and go on.
With respect to rate making, what the bill does is create a process that Oregon Community Power would engage in that's similar to a rate case that would happen at the PUC. So there would be an evidentiary hearing. In this regard, it would be a hearing with procedures that are similar to a contested case under the Administrative Procedures Act. And there would be a judge, a state administrative law judge, that would preside over the case and decide it. And the rate decision could be appealed as a contested case under ORS Chapter 183. And just one final point in conclusion. The bill does provide that the acquisition of PGE by Oregon Community Power is not subject to approval by the PUC. We think that this provision, that Enron would view this provision favorably. Some of the other options for acquiring PGE either require PUC approval or there's some uncertainty in that regard. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Brad. Jeff, do you have anything additional?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential customers of PGE. We handed out a Senate Bill 1008 summary, which lists kind of the key issues in the bill, a summary of those issues, and then a map of where to find those. It's a page and a half, and this is the bill, and kind of a cheat sheet on how to follow the bill and where the sort of key areas of interest are found. And I purposely kind of left. This is what we did present to the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee back sort of mid to end of April, and things have not changed for this proposal. and I wanted to sort of pass this out to demonstrate that. I'll talk about two things very quickly. One on governance, since there's been a lot of talk and questions about that. Basically, in coming up with the governance structure, the process, the nominating procedures, what we're trying to do is make sure that there is a couple of things are done. One is that there's some direct customer involvement and accountability. Two, that there is a role from sort of a statewide interest. And three, that there is involvement from kind of interest from throughout the state. And so what we have is our nominations from customer groups and from areas represented by cities and counties. We have gubernatorial appointment, again, kind of having that state involvement, and then Senate confirmation, having that third leg of the stool there, having input from areas all over the state, whether they're inside the service territory or have interests outside, because PGE is the state's largest electric utility. I will also note Senator Nelson talked about preference power. We share his goal to make sure that current customers of Bonneville Power Administration are held harmless. We also want to make sure that the current customers of PGE are held harmless in this as well. And so the preference section 24, is for us kind of a placeholder language. We still need some discussion on that. I just say that now for the record, and hopefully we can have other discussion at some other time. And I'll just close by saying that this is a utility that has been developed by customers, and when we're talking about public power in Oregon or anywhere else, that is the key factor, is that it's customers deciding the future of their utility. And for PGE, what the customers have come up with is Senate Bill 1008. It's a good bill, it's a clear bill, and it's something that the customer groups hope that you give due consideration. We appreciate this first shot at it and look for other discussions. Happy to answer questions. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff, I'll just start with you since you left off. If I were to have an amendment drafted for this that would delete on Section 5, lines 17 and 18, would you still be in support of this bill?
If you told us what you're replacing it with to give residential customers a voice in the selection process, and I would note, too, that the Citizens Utility Board is a group that has statutory standing to represent residential customers. So as the group that has that statutory standing, we'd like to know what you'd be replacing that that voice with.
If I just took it out?
Mr. Chair, if I would ask, why would you want to remove the voice of residential ratepayers?
And I would ask that you answer my question instead of answering it with a question.
Well, to know whether or not we would, Mr. Chair, to know whether or not we would support that, I guess what I'd ask is that we would like to have a better understanding of the thought behind the proposal, and if you're just taking it out and removing residential ratepayers, that removes an entire class of customers, and I'm not sure that by definition you are saying that there's an entire class of customers that doesn't matter, and I'm not sure we'd agree with that.
Brad, same question to you on lines 21 and 22.
Mr. Chairman, the long-term solution to the nominating committee is really in Section 4, starting at line 9, where it provides that a representative from the different customer classes will be part of the nominating committee, as well as some other local interests. The provision in Section 5 was put in for the first nominating committee, and it was really a matter of expediency so that a board could be formed in a timely manner after the passage of the bill. So as long as the basic structure of it being a customer-driven nominating committee in Section 4 was in place, we would support the bill even if you deleted the ICNU reference in Section 5.
So you would support this bill if I took out your reference by name?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct as long as the bill provided an expedient way to get a board in place, which if you just deleted that language, it might leave a gap.
So if in fact, and I think you get the gist of my question, I want to make sure that the support of the bill is on the merit of the bill and not your personal involvements in the bill, as you're specifically outlined, Associated Oregon Industries, CUB, ICNU, League of Oregon Cities, League of Oregon Counties. That's my concern, is that the merits of the bill are there. And I understand why Section 5 is there in the name of expedience, and I'm fully aware of what Section 4 says as well. That being said, and I've voiced a concern that specific organizations, lobby organizations, etc., are mentioned in this specific bill, and it gives me pause when the same groups oppose the, if you will, for lack of a better word, competing proposal out there for obvious reasons. If you have a vested interest in a bill and you're opposing a competing proposal that's out there, I just want to simply make sure that the proposals that are out there are standing on their merit and not by who supports them. So, Julie?
Mr. Chair, in anticipation of Julie Brandt, for the record, Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries, in anticipation of your question, I knew it was coming.
I gave you heads up.
Yeah, yes, you did. Never blindsided. Appreciate that. First of all, I think Brad said something. I think Brad always has a good turn of phrase. We do not see this as the only option out there. We, all three of these customer groups, are active with the City of Portland proposed acquisition. All three of these groups, by next week, I believe, will have been briefed on the stock distribution as proposed by Enron and PGE. We obviously don't have a say in that. And we are obviously on board with that because that's part of the bankruptcy plan. Our time to comment on that was during the drafting of that plan, although we will have future time during the actual proceeding at the PUC. Pardon me. I think what is important to us is that there is an expedient and customer-driven approach to how the board is formed, not just a vetting process through the gubernatorial office. I think these groups sat before your committee in opposition to one proposal this week because it lacked some of the structure that you have seen that you see here today in Senate Bill 1008. Not because we aren't part of it; it's because it's not a customer-driven proposal.
Right. I appreciate your clarification, and I appreciate you stating that for the record as well. In Section 5. Talking about the nominating committee, in Section 5, line 27, it says the nominating committee shall forward the first slate of nominees for each board person to be filled within 90 days following the effective date of this act. Now, it's my understanding that slate, each of the aforementioned proposes three names for a total of, I thought it was 21, but I can't make that add up. Is it 21 names that they present to the governor?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Jeff Bissonnette for CUB. The intention, I believe, is that for each board vacancy, and there are seven members, so this would be an initial recommendation for those seven seats. All of that whole committee, each group doesn't forward three names. All of that group forwards three names per seat, so which gives you the 21 names.
Okay. I thank you for clarifying that for me. What is the thought of I understand the need for having the cities and the counties and
you know, the commercial and industrial and residential feeling like they need a say at that. I get that. Would it be the I guess I'm looking for citizen involvement. Just John Q. citizen that really has no idea about the process per se. No clue. But all he knows is that he pays his electric bill. What type is there any role for that person on there?
Mr. Chair, from AOI's perspective, Julie Brandis again for the record. If you look at how we've handled our involvement with the City of Portland's acquisition, just as an example, we utilize our members, and those are the citizens. And our members, for example, are driving the economy. So we have Andy Anderson from Cascade Corp. serving on that. AOI had a process involved in vetting and asking the governor to consider Ray Baum for the PUC commission. I did not sit on that. I staffed that position, and that was 12 of our members, including utility members, who went through a process, interviewed about 12 candidates, and vetted Ray Baum to the governor, which he accepted. So that's how AOI would handle it. They would be
okay.
Real people, not lobbyists, so to speak.
Well, and I love lobbyists. I consider them real people. I just, you know, on section 6 of the bill, line 3 of page 4, it just says a member of the board shall have significant experience or expertise in one or more of the following areas, and outlines, you know, a pretty decent list of what could be deemed qualifications to serve on the board. And I just wanted to make sure that guy, the little guy, is represented. I think you have residential and so on and so forth, commercial. I get that whole thing. I just don't know that gets me there. But
Mr. Chair, if I might, in addition to our membership, which is a grassroots membership of some, I think, 6,000 members these days for CUB, that's also the part for both the governor who's making the appointment, who is elected by the citizens of the state, and they can voice their opinions about, and I'm sure there will be broad media coverage about who's under consideration, who's up for renewal, and that sort of thing. So I'm sure the governor will hear about that. And then, frankly, with Senate confirmation, individual senators will hear from their constituents saying, you know, this person, you know, I've had this experience, I've had that experience, good or bad. And so I'm sure that individual senators will also hear. So there, I think there's a number of ways that John J. Q. Public will sort of insert themselves, both through individual organizations, whether that be CUB, AOI, counties, cities, but directly with their direct elected representatives. And again, that was one of the reasons why we chose, you know, that approach as well.
Thank you. Mark, did Representative Brown want to testify, do you know?
Sure.
I just saw him walk in. I didn't mean to be rude and not acknowledge him. Section 11 of the bill. Line 4, do you have the bill in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It says the powers of Oregon Community Power as exercisable by the Board of Directors of Oregon Community Power or by any person delegated those powers by the Board are as follows, and it goes on to list, I guess, 22 different things that are the express power of those boards. Line 31, subsection 12, to make contracts, to set wages, to set salaries, and provide compensation for services rendered by employees and by board members, to provide for, and it lists various things. Is this saying that, I just want to make sure I understand that correctly, is this saying that the board or any person the board delegates has the ability to set wages for not only the employees, but set a salary and provide for compensation for the board themselves? I would take your time. I mean, I obviously didn't understand what it said, so I'm having to ask you.
There may be, but that's
I actually don't know the answer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, while the attorney among us kind of quickly reviews, I'll say in general terms, it is the intention to have a compensated board because of the scope and scale of the size of the utility, and to ensure that professionality of board members.
Jeff, I understand why you'd compensate somebody. But it just simply, I mean, it says to make contracts, to set wages, to set salaries, and provide compensation for services rendered. I mean, here in the state, again, like a salary schedule.
Right. And again, I think what part of the intention was, and the counselor can correct me if I'm wrong. In many corporations and many nonprofits, the board may delegate to either an executive officer, the opportunity to set salaries and that sort of thing. So again, we are trying to create something that is a public corporation, but allow it to do some flexibility so that they can attract qualified utility managers as well.
So any person that was delegated that authority by the board can make a contract, can set a wage. Let me just give you an example. If the board delegates the financial officer that you're speaking of to hire a person to do PR for the company, that person goes out and hires somebody to do PR for the company and can pay them anything that they want. I mean, is there any structure to...
Mr. Chair, I think it's also understood that the board is setting a budget, that there are staff and the staff is familiar with that budget and the budgetary constraints that are put on there. And so because of... And so I don't think that the section is intended as broadly as you were reading it.
It may not be intended to be, but would you agree that it is as broad as I am reading it?
Mr. Chair, I believe that what the intent was is to make sure that the board has broad authority, but the board itself decides what has these powers. If they choose to delegate them, they will, and they will choose to delegate them and put the parameters. The most common parameter that is put on any delegation is within the budget that the board itself adopts, and that's any organizational structure.
Okay, so the budget that the board adopts, the salaries have to fit within.
In any organizational structure, that's usually how it happens. And if a senior manager or the chief executive officer pays something that breaks the budget, there's usually a pretty serious discussion between the board and that senior officer or that chief executive.
Nothing in here about how high the budget can be, though, right?
Well, there is the board is accountable to the customers, and I suppose if the board likes serving as the board and is actually acting in the interest of customers, they're going to be wanting to keep a pretty tight rein on expenses, and so we're going to be adopting a budget that is commensurate with the revenue and trying to reduce costs because they are serving in the interest of customers, because that's the only interest group that this board is representing. There are no shareholders, there are no other outside interests that are.
Jeff, I'm going to let you off the hook.
Okay.
Okay. We'll talk about that later, because I'm fully aware that you don't have a good answer for that. So I'm fine with that.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, if I can just make one point on that.
Brad, you can make as many points as you would like.
Thank you. Ultimately, the board is serving at the pleasure of the governor, and if they're guilty of mismanaging the utility, they can be removed for cause. And I think, overpaying a consultant or whatever, if it rose to the level sort of the extreme that you're suggesting, or an undue delegation, that they would be subject to removal. And it's much the same as the PUC. They could authorize the utility to recover completely unreasonable costs. But I think if they did that, then they also might be subject to removal.
But at least at the PUC, there's an accountability issue between the company and the ratepayer. In this situation, it would be, I think it was section talking about the administrative judge in rate cases, or in section 6, line 10 of page 4, it says the governor may remove any member of the board for cause after notice and public hearing. Well, if I'm a member of the board and I say this is my budget and this is my salary and it fits within the budget that I've also set, that's not exactly negligent. It's simply within the parameters that I'm given right here. You can say it's too much, but it's not negligent.
Mr. Chairman, I think the theory was is that the board members would be compensated in the same way that board members of similar private companies are compensated. So I think that would at least establish a bar for comparison.
And Mr. Chair, with accountability, if a board member, sort of went over the edge, he probably wouldn't find himself on the list of a nominating committee when that person's seat was up.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think Gary has something to say, but I wanted to know if you had any other questions for AOI, because I have to take my daughter to a dentist appointment.
Please get her there safely.
Sorry.
Gary, do you have something related to salaries?
Well, it's related to Section 11, Mr. Chair, which is where this whole section comes from, and I think I can help frame a little bit of the question you were asking. In working with Legislative Council and developing the text for Senate Bill 1008, the goal that we asked Dexter, who is here, by the way, is to make sure that we gave Oregon Community Power the ability to function in a business-like manner as a utility. And I think that the initial question you ask about subsection 12 is a reflection of attempting to make sure that that Oregon Community Power would have the ability to have a general manager in effect. That's the intention.
Okay. We'll work on that section. The next section that I had a question with is section 15, line 17. Talking about eminent domain. It says to acquire, line 17B, it says to acquire any property for a purpose, I'm sorry, I circled the wrong one. It says Oregon Community, section 15, Oregon Community Power may exercise the power of eminent domain for the purposes of acquiring any property within or outside the service territory of Oregon Community Power. Now, if you're inside the territory or you're outside the territory, is it fair to say that that's the state of Oregon or not?
Mr. Chair, in PGE's case, that's generally true.
Okay. Now, it goes on to within or outside the service territory of Oregon Community Power necessary for carrying out sections 1 to 4, 6, 9 to 9 to 19, and 45 of this 2005 Act. Section 2 reads, Oregon Community Power is created as a public corporation. Oregon Community Power shall exercise and carry out all powers, rights, and privileges that are conferred upon Oregon Community Power expressly or by implication, or that are incidental to otherwise conferred powers, rights, and privileges. My question is, that seems to really cover everything. So they're really, and I see the on section 17, when it goes on to the subsection 2, lines 16 and 17, notwithstanding subsection 1, eminent domain may not be used, and it says to acquire service territory of another electric utility or to acquire any property for a purpose that is unrelated to electric utility operations. I get those two exemptions, but with cause to just those two exemptions, that's pretty broad language, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Chair, it may or may not be. Utilities particularly such as PGE, have, in addition to distribution system that serves its service territory, it also has transmission lines, has access to the intertie, it has generating facilities, much of which is outside of its service territory. And utilities are constantly in the business of doing substations, making other improvements, mainly for safety and power reliability purposes. What we've attempted to do here is to provide this customer-owned utility with a set of abilities to use eminent domain when necessary in the conduct of its normal utility business, no more, no less.
Okay. And I, one second. And I get that, and it's not that I don't believe you or think there's ulterior motives here. I'm just saying, as the language is written, it really doesn't specify. I mean, for example, could they acquire large amounts of land for the potential purpose to put a substation on, whether or not they do or don't? I mean, would that be permissible under this language?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I think utilities undoubtedly do have to engage in some land banking. For example, PGE has acquired land outside of its service territory for certain generating capacity and transmission lines. So I think your question's a good one. We can actually, working both with our own council and legislative council, look to make sure that we're not inadvertently doing something, but as I described it was our intent. If we somehow have overreached that, that wasn't our intent, and if correcting or more narrowing language is appropriate, I think we would have no objection to that.
Okay, and again, I'm not trying to infer that that's the modus operandi of
Mr. Chair. These are excellent questions, and this is one of the reasons why we actually believe that having a legislative process review the creation of a utility at the level of detail that we're now having this discussion is a very good thing. So what you're doing, we encourage.
Thank you, Gary. Billy?
Representative Dalto?
Representative Palmo, sorry. Fair enough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For Mr. Conkling, on the example that was cited about PGE purchase or acquiring land outside of their service territory to make accommodations for future needs, was that land purchased privately, or was that through some kind of eminent domain function? And does, in fact, PGE currently have eminent domain power?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalta, the PGE does, and all utilities do have a limited form of eminent domain power, such that they can acquire easements and right-of-ways to build transmission lines and that kinds of thing. They don't have the exact same power as governmental authorities do.
And my first question?
Can you repeat the question?
My question was, did PGE acquire the land that is currently outside of their service territory through private acquisition or through the eminent domain power?
Representative Dalto, it's my understanding that, for instance, with the transmission corridor that will bring the Newport Westward plant into PGE system, that part of those right-of-ways were acquired through private transactions, and part of them are being acquired through eminent domain proceedings.
So if I might, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
One more question. Thank you. So I note the diagram of the PGE service territory here, but I note following along the Chair's line of thought about the expansion of this full eminent domain power that is conferred in Section 15, but also builds on Section 2 of a pretty impressive scope of powers to this public corporation. I just wonder at what point this Oregon community power stops at the PGE service territory or considers moving beyond the PGE service territory and putting it into competition with other power territories using the public corporation and eminent domain power.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, I think the way that the bill answers that is that most of the state is already allocated through service territory agreements and exclusive service territory allocations, and the bill specifically approves those arrangements. So, in other words, Oregon Community Power wouldn't be able to try to serve the customers of Pacific Core or any other utility.
Can you point me, Mr. Chair, one final question? Could you point me to the language in Senate Bill 1008 that sets forth that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalton, I think it's Section 23, which provides that the successor in interest to PGE shall be subject to the allocation of territories and contracts of PGE.
Wouldn't that also be touched on in Section 15, sub 2, when it says to acquire service, notwithstanding, you may not use it to acquire service territory or another electric utility?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I might note that this particular language was developed by the customers working with both Pacific Core and customer-owned utilities, and I'm not suggesting that they have broader views one way or another about the bill, but this was specifically included to accommodate their interest that the utility would not be able to use these powers to acquire their territory.
Mr. Chair, my question was thoroughly answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dalto. One final question from me, and that is would Oregon Community Power be subject to public records laws?
Mr. Chair, again, referring back to the list that Legislative Council provided, you will note that public records and public meetings law are included in the list that of state laws that do apply to Oregon Community Power. So the answer would be yes.
Gary, you are absolutely right. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
I notice public records laws apply, public meetings laws do not do apply, but the public contracting does not apply. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's correct.
And can I ask what the reasoning behind that is?
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, the concept here was to create a customized utility to operate as closely like a professional business organization as possible. Public contracting and prevailing wage provisions, and not to dismiss them, are important. In my other representations in this building, I work with them and actively support those. But the notion here was that what we were creating was an organization that was taking over a private utility or investor-owned utility, and the attempt was to try to make it as similar to that organization as possible, other than the fact that it's a public corporation and would operate as a customer-owned utility.
My next question would be, since I'm vice chair, he's no longer, would be, if we're trying to get a citizen-owned or a publicly owned utility, essentially, mm-hmm. and trying to keep the rates as low as possible, and yet I just kind of missed a little accountability piece there as far as public contracting, and I mention that only because I've heard instances of other, I will not mention the names of other public corporations that we have that do not abide by public contracting laws, and I know that there's other entities that aren't able to compete for certain contracts with them for whatever reason, though they know they can provide the service for much cheaper, the same service, better quality, yet they're shut out from that process. And it just seems like that isn't serving the corporation wouldn't serve the corporation, the rates and the cost that would be necessary to maintain the corporations.
Madam Vice Chair, I don't know that what was included or excluded was done so on a basis of cost. So I can assure you, in fact, that it was not. Looking at what something included here or there for one reason or another would probably not be accurate in terms of how it was actually determined what would be included or not included. I think that the simple test was to try to simulate a customer-owned utility in the form of a public corporation that would act as close to a professional business-like organization, or similar, in fact, to PGE today, as possible. No more, no less. Now, these are policy judgments to some degree, and so people could reach different policy conclusions than the ones that are included in the bill. But that's what they are, as policy judgments.
Okay. My next question was clarifying something I heard Brad say, I think, earlier, that they would offer direct access to all non-residential customers, same as the process is now, but the offer to residential customers would be left to the board. And I'm just wondering, did I understand that correctly? And what is the process that is in place now for PGE?
Madam Chair, Jeff Bissonnette for the Citizens Utility Board. Right now, residential customers do not have direct access, mainly because we don't want it. It doesn't serve us. We would like to be have the guarantee to service that the utility provides, and that's the policy today, and that would be the policy under Senate Bill 1008. Commercial customers, industrial customers, most commercial customers and industrial customers have direct access, want to keep that, and so the effort was to make sure that was continued under a public ownership of this model, because Senate Bill 1149 ordinarily does not apply to consumer-owned utilities in the state, and so we wanted to make very clear that although this would be a consumer-owned utility, that all of the policies currently that PGE is subject to as an investor-owned utility would also apply if Senate Bill 1008 came into being.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. We're going to have to move on. So you have a final question, if it's that
final
important.
Question. You would create a process similar to the rate cases done with the PUC, and then if there's any conflicts, they would be resolved with the state administrative law judge. Now, is this an open process, do you think, in your mind, or the administrative law judges are?
Vice Chair Thatcher, yes, that's correct. It would be a contested case rate hearing before an administrative law judge from the state administrative law judge pool. And everyone would have the opportunity to present evidence, make arguments in that process.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, if I might just add to that.
Final comment, Gary.
The existing Public Utility Commission rate-setting process is an evidentiary-based one. The Public Utility Commissioners themselves must make a decision about rates based on actual evidence presented, and what the customers have attempted to do is to create a system that I refer to it as being more elegant and less expensive than the current system, but to simulate something similar to that for Oregon Community Power using an administrative law judge to serve basically as that referee. That's what they've done.
Thank you, Gary, and panel, thank you. And Gary, if obviously there's been a few concerns raised, if you and I can work on some language there, that would be great. Is Ken around, Strobeck? I told him I skipped him so he could be next. Sandy, are you needing to testify? I see that you're checked neutral. Do you have some...
You'll have another opportunity. So, Ken, you want to come up and tell the committee you're neutral?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ken Strobeck with the League of Oregon Cities. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about Senate Bill 1008. The League of Oregon Cities represents all 240 cities in Oregon, and in this case, we're speaking on behalf of the 52 cities, including the City of Portland, that are within the PGE service territory. And I'm handing out to you now a statement of principles that were adopted, that was adopted about 2 years ago by the League of Oregon Cities Board when the very first proposals came forward regarding the sale of PGE, when at that time it was involved in the Enron bankruptcy. And paramount on our list of requirements, regardless of who acquires the utility, whether it is publicly owned or privately owned, is the retaining of all local franchise fees, property taxes, and the current structure of tax payments that are involved with PGE as a private company. This is particularly important in Oregon and in the service territory of PGE because of the fact that franchise fees, due to our property tax limitations and so forth and other tax limitations, franchise fees comprise about the second largest source of municipal revenue for cities in Oregon, and that's critically important to be able to maintain those.
Yeah, I think in Section 24 it pretty much outlines and preserves your ability to nickel and dime those folks as you would see fit. Most all of your concerns that are outlined on your principles, is that kind of the genesis of Section 24 of the bill?
Mr. Chair, yes. Senators Deckard and Nelson and Representative Berger worked with us in involving that the creation of that language and the insertion in it, and they're fully on board with that principle, and I'll keep my testimony brief. Sounds like you want to move along. I just want to also say that I serve on the advisory council on the Portland sale of PGE, and these are the very same principles that we're advancing in that forum as well.
Is the City of Portland's proposal, which nobody knows what it is because it's confidential, does that incorporate your principles also into their proposal? And can you say that or not?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the deliberations of the Advisory Council are public, and the provisions that are being put forth in the governance of that proposal are also public, and they include those provisions as well.
Okay, so you're taken care of on both accounts.
If it's a public power entity in that form, yes, we are.
Okay. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Sandy, you want to just go ahead and testify today, or you want to wait till next?
We're going to be very
brief. Okay. Or do you think I'm in a hurry or something?
I'm not yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor, Director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We represent the existing city-owned electric utilities in Oregon. It's Sandy Flicker with the Rural Electric Cooperatives, and Libby Henry with Eugene Water and Electric Board. Mr. Chair, we are here today, and we're involved in the discussions around Senate Bill 1008 for two very elemental reasons. One is that the utility system in Oregon and the Northwest is an interrelated system. You can't do something to a utility the size of PGE and not affect every other utility in the state of Oregon. Secondly, As small consumer-owned utilities, we are almost entirely dependent on the power that we receive from the Bonneville Power Administration to serve our customers. Any change in the status of PGE affects or has the potential to affect our power supply, and therefore we did. That's the those two reasons alone are our interest in this legislation. Our fundamental concern is that the formation of some new entity out of PGE, regardless of what its structure is, our concern would be that that not cause a cost shift to the existing consumer-owned utilities in Oregon. As I mentioned, again, we buy all of our power primarily from Bonneville, and Bonneville has a finite amount of power to go around. They are pretty much in what we call load resource balance right now, meaning that there's not extra power to go around. Several years ago during the energy crisis, Bonneville was about 1,300 megawatts short. They had to go out and buy power on the open market. Our rate shot up over 50%. It was a terrible experience for our consumers, and we don't want to go through it again. In contrast, I guess, quickly to our situation, PGE is really the 800-pound gorilla of Oregon utilities, and I don't mean that in a negative manner, just in terms of size. They have, as Mr. Conkling talked about, significant generation resources. They own a piece of the North-South intertie and are able to move power up and down between here and California. And they also have, of course, a huge staff and marketing capability. So whoever takes over that entity has tremendous resources to draw on. And our concern would be, again, that in whatever structure is created, that it not be able to draw upon Bonneville in addition to their own resources in such a way that it would cause our rates to go up because there wouldn't be enough power to go around. We've had amendments to deal with that in 1008 because the now there's discussion about all different kinds of entities that might be formed to do this. We had...
I knew the answer. No.
I was just going to say we had to ask those amendments to be drafted and thought they would be ready. But, Mr. Chair, we were trying to cover the situation if any entity were to take over PGE. And with that, I'll stop.
So basically, Section 24, A and B, of 24 that talk about the federal electric power, which essentially right. is referred to on lines 36, which means Bonneville for the purposes of this section. It doesn't prohibit them from using the Bonneville. So isn't that what your amendments are going to do?
Mr. Chair, it makes a differentiation between power and financial benefits. It says that they does not draw upon power, but it would be eligible for financial benefits as they are now. Mr. Chair, just briefly add that in response to Representative Dalto's question also, which I appreciate your calling out, Section 36 that we put in the bill also speaks to maintaining the exclusive distribution rights of consumer-owned utilities, which would be designed to ensure that the new entity, whatever its powers, could not, as you are concerned about, take over our systems. There's also language in Section 15.2A that prohibits the use of eminent domain to take over our service territory or anyone else. And finally, I guess just quickly in response to Representative Thatcher's question, existing municipal utilities anyway are subject to public contracting and prevailing wage requirements.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, let me, Sandy Flicker for the record, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association. I just wanted to make a clarification for the committee so that we make sure that you understand. Language, Section 24 of Senate Bill 1008, establishes a policy for no cost shifting between PGE customers and customers of consumer-owned utilities in Oregon's smaller and rural communities.
Right.
What we're asking this committee to consider is a small amendment to Section 24, which would replace Oregon, well, would continue to say Oregon Community Power, but would also say, and any other entity that purchases, public or private, that purchases Portland General Electric. So in other words, if the Oregon Mutual, if there's a new configuration, if the city of Portland were to purchase, then that policy would be established for any of those purchases of Portland General Electric. And again, that is to guarantee that for the 300,000 or so electricity customers of the small communities in Oregon, that there is no cost shift onto them with any formation, any new formation of Portland General Electric. So we will be having those amendments. We will get them to you just as quickly as we get them from Legislative Council. Thank you for your consideration.
Sandy, and thank you. And if I wasn't clear prior to that, I am now.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Olivia Henry with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I'm here on a slightly different issue. I'm here on an issue regarding ownership of the Trojan Nuclear Plant, which is now a waste facility, and the assumption of some responsibility along with the other owners and whomever takes over this utility. The language I actually have, I've got some talking points to speak to what is Inspection 46, which you have now in the printed bill. So, and this is already passed in House Bill 3479 with standalone language, passed the House 57-1. I can go over that and review that real quickly so you know what that language means. And then we have two clarifying amendments to go with that. I can come back and do it later.
I think that you would be in the best interest of the committee to do just that.
Okay. Thank you.
So, because you will have another opportunity. We've already been here for almost 2 hours. So I know that Representative Holvey and Representative Dalton, for sure, but Representative Thatcher have been in other committees for 3 hours today alongside this one. So we'll just hear that later if that's
sure.
Okay, since it's a totally separate issue.
I have a number to deal
with. And I can't wait.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on 10:08. And we will adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.